In that last verse, it's that Sangye Chodo, and this is Gaki Jinso. If you're just reading it in general, as a prayer, you say Gaki Jinso. If you are about to start a Dharma class and you're one of the people who's listening, you say Gaki Chinyin. Okay, Gaki Chinyin. Instead of Jinso, you say Chinyin. Okay. You ought to write it on your notebook, maybe. Okay. Instead of Daki Jinso, you say Daki Chunyin. Okay. Which means by the virtue of my listening to this class. Okay. And if you're teaching the class, you say Daki Chishe. Which means by the virtue of my teaching the class. Okay. All right. The next point in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha talks about Lungtenba. Okay. Say Lungtenba. Lungtenba. It's also called Lungdutenba. Lung means the word. We had it in Lungichu, right? And Dokpichu, we had Lungichu. Tenba means to give the word. And this is a, I don't know what you want to call it in English, but it's where the Buddha comes up to you, you know, and he puts his hand on your head and he says, okay, 6 more lives, you're going to be a Buddha named Shakyamuni, you know. And it's some special event in a person's spiritual life. You know, a Buddha comes to you and puts their hands on you and says, I foresee. Lungtenba means to predict or to give the prediction. I foresee that in now, because of the stage you have reached at this point, you will become Buddha named such and such within so many lives. Okay, it's a big threshold for Buddhists, right? And in the sutra, the Buddha is describing an event of Lungtenba. He starts talking about an event when a Lungtenba happened. The Lungtenbi, the person who got the Lungten was named, say, Chukitin. Chukitin. Chu means Dharma. Ki means of, and Chin means cloud. Cloud of Dharma. Okay, Chukitin. And, this was a youth, it's called Shunun Chukitin, so it was a young man at that time. The Buddha who was doing the prediction, say Mamenze, Mamenze. Mamen means like a butter lamp. Mar means butter, Men means lamp, and it's like one of those offering lamps. De means maker, the maker of a butter lamp. In Sanskrit it's called Dipamkara. Dipamkara. This is also a name of Atisha. Lord Atisha was called Dipamkara also. But this is not referring to Dipamkara. This is referring to a Buddha who came before our Buddha. And his name was Dipamkara. So in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha is describing to Subhuti an event where a Buddha named Chukitin, a young man named Chukitin got that prediction from a Buddha named Marmeze. And that, because he had reached a certain level called the eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi, okay, Sagyepa, because he had reached the eighth level, the eighth Bodhisattva level, because of that, Chukichin had reached that, then Marmeze, Dipamkara, that Buddha came and said, okay, I'm going to tell you the future, you know, after so many lives, you will become a Buddha on a certain planet, and your name will be Shakyamuni, okay. All right. Your name, you will become a Buddha. You will be on a planet called Earth, and your name will be Shakyamuni. So this is actually referring to the Buddha, our Buddha. Okay, the Buddha in our world. And he got that prediction because he had reached level number 8. And there's a particular state of mind at that level that I want to talk about today. Okay. Say Mikyewe, Chela, Sepa. Mikyewe, Chela, Sopa. Gila means grow. Mi means what? Won't grow. Okay, Migila means won't grow. Chila means generally any kind of thing. Dharma for it. Chila means dharma, but it means any kind of existing thing. So Migila Chila means something that's not going to grow in the future. Okay. In the monastery, people have all these philosophical terms, and they use them as secret code when they're in a restaurant or something. You know, like if the the waiter is slow in Mysore, you say, oh, this dinner is really a Mikirwe Chir, you know. This is a future dharma that won't occur. Okay. That's called a Mikirwe Chir. Chila Sipa. Sipa generally means patience in the sense of the ability to not get angry or to not get upset. That's Sipa. And when you're talking about what we've been talking about for the last 3-4 days, when you're talking about achieving all these high levels of realization, sipa takes on a completely different meaning, and it means mastery.
Okay.
Mastery. Total mastery over something. So this spiritual level called Nikewe Chula Sipa has two flavors to it. Two things are going on. Something's not going to grow anymore, and you have a total mastery over something. There's two elements here, Nikewecha and Sipa. And that happens at the eighth bodhisattva bhumi, the eighth bodhisattva level. How do you get to the first bodhisattva level?
Nah.
That's the first path. Huh? Yeah, when you see emptiness directly with bodhicitta, you reach... In other words, you reach the path of seeing, path number 3. You become an Arya. You see emptiness directly. And if you have bodhicitta in your heart at that moment, by the way, is it directly present in your mind? Is it manifest in your mind at that moment? Can't be. Okay? We say it imbues your mind, but it cannot, you cannot be thinking, I want to save all living beings because living beings are not ultimate reality. The only thing that can present itself to your mind at that moment is ultimate reality, emptiness. Okay. But you do have bodhicitta, we call it simba, imbued. Your mind is soaked in bodhicitta. So if you see emptiness directly, with bodhicitta in your mind, soaking your mind, not manifest in your mind, you reach first bodhisattva bhumi. At the same time that you reach the third path on the bodhisattva track, okay, the path of seeing. Okay, that's all those things happen at the same time. So you can imagine that reaching level number 8 is a long trip. Okay, bodhisattva level number 8. Number 10 is like enlightenment. All right, but we're talking about number 8. Number 8 is where you reach Mikewe Chö La Sopa. So Mikewe Chö, what do you think is the thing that won't grow anymore? Mental afflictions. Okay. Reaching level 8 on the bodhisattva track and getting to nirvana on the bodhisattva track are the same thing. Okay? At level 8, you reach nirvana. Okay? You still have 2 levels more to go before you reach total enlightenment, Buddha paradise. Okay? And all those bodies that we talked about. Okay? So at this point, you've only reached nirvana. Nirvana is defined as what? Permanent elimination of mental afflictions due to seeing the four truths one by one after seeing emptiness directly. Having that whole day's experience that we described after seeing emptiness directly. Soso tope gopa. Soso tangok it's called. Soso tangok means you got rid of something because of something else. There's 2 kinds of cessations generally. I mean, you don't have to go into it much, but soso tangok means you got to a cessation because you saw emptiness directly and then saw those four truths one by one and all those things that were in those four truths. There are cessations that you reach that don't depend on seeing emptiness directly, and they're called soso tangmingigopa, which means they don't depend on that process of seeing those four. An example would be at a certain point in the path of preparation, due to the goodness of understanding emptiness intellectually, you can no longer take birth in the lower realms. Impossible. Totally impossible. Can't happen after that. path of preparation. At a certain point, I think it's Drolam Sopa, which means mastery, and it's the name of your root lama. Probably mastery and patience, right? You can no longer be born in the lower realms. Impossible. That's a gog. That's a gogpa. That's a cessation. That's the end of something. But it didn't come about through seeing emptiness directly and seeing the Four Noble Truths one by one. So we call it sotapa mingi gogpa, which means a cessation that doesn't depend on that. There's two kinds of cessations. So we're talking now about the eighth bodhisattva level. The person has, for this person, mental afflictions are mikewechu, which means what? They're not going to happen again. Okay? The point is that they can't happen again. You cannot have another case of a mental affliction. And I thought it would be cool to go over the mental afflictions, just so you could enjoy what you're not going to have. All right? So I'm going to go over the mental afflictions just very briefly. I mean, if you're having a whole course about wiping these things out of your mind, out of your heart, it'd be nice to know exactly what you're getting rid of. There are six major mental afflictions. We talked about it last Friday night. There are six major mental afflictions. And there are 20 minor mental afflictions, secondary. And there's tens of thousands of variants. Tens of thousands of different flavors. It's worse than Baskin-Robbins. Okay. Thousands and thousands of different flavors of mental afflictions. But mainly, six principal ones, 20 secondary ones. What's the difference between a major mental affliction and a minor mental affliction? Rang Denbe Kazaki, Sem Yugodumen Nema, Shiwar Chepe, Sem Chung, is the definition of a root mental affliction. It's a kind of thought that once it occurs in the mind of the person that it's attacking, disturbs their peace of mind in a major way. That's major mental affliction. It ruins your peace of mind in many ways, in a major way. So, for example, if you had one of these six occur in your mind, it would mess up your day, your whole day. All right, and it would become obsessed. I mean, it would hurt you. It would ruin your peace of mind substantially. Like maybe for an hour or 2 hours, your mind wouldn't be at peace. And that's the definition of a mental affliction. The definition of a mental affliction is Rang Denbe Kazaki Senju Mashiwa Chepa. It messes up the peace of mind of the person who has it. Okay. So what would the opposite be? I mean, if you didn't have them, you'd always have peace of mind. It's very interesting. Okay. You would always have peace of mind. Conversely, if you're not feeling very good at any particular time, you know, if you're feeling upset or stressed or irritated or what's happening, you must have a mental affliction. Okay. It's a sign. If you don't feel whole, if you don't feel at peace, if you don't feel contented at any given moment, there must be a mental affliction running in your mind. Okay. Major or minor? Minor is the definition of a secondary mental affliction is that it ruins your peace of mind from a specific angle. Okay. For example, jealousy is a secondary. Jealousy makes your heart feel bad from a very specific angle, which is you find it distasteful that someone else should have something good happen to them. Definition of jealousy, you know. It bothers you that someone else could have something good happen to them. And bodhicitta is like praying that everyone could get everything they ever wished for. So the minute you have jealousy, then forget bodhicitta. It's impossible. Jealousy is like, I wish this person wouldn't have got this nice thing happen to them. And bodhicitta is, I'm going to work my whole life so that everyone gets everything they ever wished for. And it's totally opposite. But anyway, minor mental afflictions, secondary ones, they ruin your contentment or your peace of mind from a very specific angle. We don't have time to go over all 26. I'm going to go over the six main ones. Yeah. I'm going to do all six. And I'm doing them from the point of view of Mikyewe Chö. okay, from a rather optimistic point of view, okay, these are the guys that you are going to kick out of your mind permanently when you see emptiness directly, because you had a good class about Diamond Cutter Sutra, okay? So these are going to be the friends who move out of your house. Say Dirchat? Dirchat? Dirchat means desire. They say desire. It's supposed to be like the worst mental affliction. You know, anger you get once a week or once every, depends on what your problems are. By the way, if you're in this realm, if you're sitting at Vajrapani Institute, and if you're not a tantric deity in disguise, okay, which I don't know. I tell you, I'm not, but I don't know about you guys. And if you haven't achieved, even if you have achieved nirvana in this life, the reason you're here is because you have these. The best person in the desire realm and the worst person in the desire realm are about an inch apart. Okay? I mean, we all have these six. All over the world, no matter what language you speak, no matter what country you live in, what you eat for dinner, what your face looks like, if you're in the desire realm, you got here because you have them. And that's another thing you understand at the path of seeing, in the Jetobyeshi, in the aftermath. You understand that there really are three realms, and you understand that if you're here, and if you're in a body like this, which is much worse than it looks, okay, if you're in a dead-end body like this, which can only die and hurt you, it's because you have mental afflictions, and that's what got you here. Okay, if you're human, you were very, very virtuous, but you still had mental afflictions. If you were pure on the inside, the outside wouldn't look like this. Okay. And if your outside looks like this, or anything close, you have mental afflictions, and you're here because of that. The evidence is that you're here. You wouldn't be here if you didn't have them. Okay. So the first one is Dirchat. I want to read you the technical definition of Dirchat. Okay. It's a Sacheki Nyobola Yondu Nangni Ranto Kimendawa Dibbe Semba Semjung Semba. Sacheki Nyobola means it must be directed at a samsaric object. And that's important. That's very important. Like, is it a mental affliction to desire nirvana, or to desire to get out of this state, or to desire to be like Lama Yeshe, or something like that? You know, is that a mental affliction? No. Stop shaking, Lopala, which means it has to be focused on a samsaric object, on a dirty object, on a suffering object. Okay. Like, you know, everyone saying how nice you are because you're teaching this class, you know, and you get attached to that. That's dirchat, okay? That's desire. That kind of desire is towards a dirty object, samsaric object. Getting well known, okay? You own the nangne. You own the nangne means that samsaric object must be appearing to you as if it were attractive. Okay? As if it were something nice. They call it Sipe Punto, Jetson Kapa. It means it has to be something that seems good in samsara. And the word seem is obviously very important. Okay. At sometimes your body seems pretty cool. You know, sometimes your life seems pretty cool. Sometimes a promotion would seem nice. A raise or a bonus would seem very nice. I haven't seen them for a long time. These are you on the Nawa. These are things that look as if they were nice, or like a good dinner. But we know that good dinner is the scriptural example of suffering number two, okay? Because you always get hungry after that. And hungry is part of the good dinner. Getting hungry is part of the good dinner. If you could cut the good dinner off at dessert, right after the coffee, before the bill, then it would be, you know, that would be happiness. But the tail of the dog, there's always this tail attached to the dog, and that's that you got to pay the bill and you got to get hungry again, and that is attached to every dinner that you can ever have. That makes the dinner suffering. Buddhists are very careful to, they don't cut the dinner off at the coffee and the dessert. They say getting hungry is a necessary part of the dinner, so therefore the dinner is lousy.
Okay.
If you have to get hungry again, then the dinner is lousy.
Okay, so...
So two parts of desire so far. It has to be focused on a samsaric object, and that object has to appear nice to you. Rantongki mindawa dabbe simba simjung.
Simjung simba.
Which means... in and of it, well, by itself, which is a long story, I won't talk about that, but you get this desire not to lose the object. That's the third component. You start to have a feeling that you don't want to lose this thing. Minjawa dupa means you don't want to be separated or to lose this object. So those are the three things you need for desire. The object has to be samsara. Secondly, it has to look nice to you. Look is very important, right? And then thirdly, you have to not want to lose it.
Okay.
It's only this kind of emotion that would make you do something wrong not to lose it. And that's the problem with desire.
Okay.
The problem with desire is that the next step in the food chain is that it triggers some kind of activity or thoughts that are not wholesome. You undertake some activity of mind, speech, or body to keep the thing, to keep yourself from losing the thing, and that's why desire gets you in trouble.
Okay.
And there's a whole chain there, I'm not going to do it in this course, but it's really, really cool about how ignorance triggers all these steps, ending in you say something back to the boss, you know.
Okay.
Or you're chasing after something that you desire. Okay, definition number two. Oh, so by the way, this mental friction is supposed to be in your mind all the time. I don't like to call it desire very much. I mean, okay, call it desire, but when you think about this mental friction, it's what you call liking something.
Okay.
It's more prevalent than desire. Desire to me means, you know, watching an X-rated movie in a hotel room at 3 o'clock, you know, or something, you know, then I get desire or something. But this is happening in your mind constantly. As you sit in this class for the length of this class, this mental affliction will occur maybe 200 times or something. I want to get in the shade, you know, I want the class to end a little sooner today. I want to have a good lunch. You know, I mean, you're going to have these, all of those objects they fit the bill. You know, they're samsaric objects. They seem like they'd be nice, and you don't want to lose them. Yeah. They do have to ruin your whole day. Let's say altogether they ruin your whole day. Yeah. Say again? Oh, I'm talking about the desire to get out of the class. generally, if you're having the right... Is a class samsara? Is a Buddhist book samsara? There's a big debate about it. Sakche lamgi dembadan duma chenam sunyante. Lama tope duchenam sakche. All changing things are samsaric, except for the path.
Okay.
All changing things... That's the opening line to the Abhidhamma Kosha. All changing things are samsaric except for the path. Are the books the path? By the way, path means tapa. Path means realization in the mind of a person. In the mind of a person. That's the definition of path. And then they discuss the books and they decide, well, we'll call them Lamgi Jedang, which means ancillary path. Okay? Auxiliary path. We'll count them in the path. Technically speaking, they're almost samsara.
Okay.
Boy, lots of questions. We'll do like two because we got a long class. Yeah.
I would have thought the books were empty and it would depend on our projection.
That's true too. I mean, when the Dalai Lama has lunch, I don't think it's the suffering of change for him. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
That's my question.
Yeah.
The things themselves aren't really
samsara. No. Well, it's hard to say, but in general, any object in the desire realm is samsara. There's a big debate about whether the the appearance of an arhat is samsara. You know, when you look at Lama Sopa, is the shape and color of his body samsara? Yeah. For us, it's samsara because you can have mental afflictions toward it. If it can generate a mental affliction in you, it's samsara. That's the definition of sakti in the Abhidhamma. Sadhanam kundu gyabhagyun. Which means, okay. Yeah. Well, no, there's people who hate the Dalai Lama, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, if you're desiring it in order to get knowledge, spiritual knowledge, and especially in order to help others, it's not samsara. But it's very close. It's really close. I mean, technically speaking, the shape and color of the book are samsara.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it would be less samsara. There's a big debate. The Abhidhamma calls it jedang, langi jedang, which means not quite path, which is mental, but conducive to the path. So let's throw it in with pure things, non-samsaric things. But it's very subtle. And 99% of all that you experience, even in a Dharma center, is samsara. Is samsaric and is promoting samsara. That's a long story. Okay. Second one is, well, what I wanted to say was this is more prevalent than you think. It's not desire in the sense of having a big desire, Mac attack, you know. It's going on in your mind constantly, and it's making you unhappy from moment to moment, hour to hour, month to month. It's what makes you feel restless, or that you can't quite be fulfilled, or you can't be contented. This is dushyanta.
Okay.
And by the way, the point of the class is that you cannot remove that by any other means than seeing emptiness directly.
Okay.
Say kongto? Kongto? People translate it as anger, but listen to the definition. Shisumbo kanyang rungwa langa tongki misobe samjung samba, which means shisumbo, I haven't been able to find in the scriptures. I take it to mean the three components that we talked about of an action, like the doer, the object, and the action itself. But it has a lot of different meanings in scripture, and I haven't been able to satisfy myself. I believe it means the elements of any situation. Let's call it any situation. Okay. Kaya rumala means towards any of those. Rantoki, of its own power, misupe semchum, can no longer stand it. Okay. A state of mind where you can no longer stand any particular part of a situation. Okay. Sometimes they say Dharan Dupa, which means the desire to get separated from that object, okay? The desire to get away from that object. Samsaric object. Okay. I shouldn't say that, that's a little tricky. Let's say the desire to get away from any particular object or part of a situation because you can't stand it anymore. You don't like it. Okay. That's kontō. So it's a lot more subtle than anger, I think. I think it's like disliking things. This is something that's running in your mind all day long. I don't like this bug, it's buzzing in my ear. I just had a kontō, okay? And like that.
Okay.
I'm going to get more into this later, but what's wrong with that? I mean, when I get mad at the bug and I go like that, you know, what's the problem? It's ignorant action. That mental affliction is triggering an ignorant action. How do I get rid of, if I don't like bugs, how should I get rid of bugs? Take care of them. Yeah, take care of them. I mean, when my lama, we had roaches in our house. And when he wanted to get rid of them, you know, you have a choice. You can squash them. Or he would put out food for them, let them have a nice dinner, and then catch them in glasses and take them outside. And if you've ever lived in New York or New Jersey, I mean, this can be a long process. And he did it for like 3 or 4 years. And he just carefully took them one by one outside for 3 or 4 years. And then they just have totally disappeared. They have not come back. They have not appeared. They're gone. That's the difference between doing it with a mental affliction, which would be crushing them, because that's stupid. According to the laws of karma, which are allowed to work because of emptiness, they'll just come back worse. He would go a long way and put them, he was worried in the winter that they would be cold. So we have a compost heap. And he put it way away from the house and put them in the compost heap. They wouldn't freeze in the cold winter. They don't do too well in the snow. No, not like that. We'll talk about it. Okay. If that would be pleasure, I guess so. I was going to bring it up later today, in fact later in this class, but just to anticipate, the act of patience, of not getting, excuse my language, pissed off, is can be practiced towards animate or inanimate objects. Okay. In other words, if you get angry waiting for a bus, because it doesn't show up, which happens a lot in where I live, you have created a bad karma. And you have broken the perfection of patience.
Okay.
Or if you, the example in scripture is stubbing your toe on a rock and cursing the rock.
Okay.
It doesn't hurt the rock, but you've broken the perfection of patience, which means not getting angry. Na means me. Gel means king. What's Nagyal? Pride. Okay. Nagyal is pride. There are 9 flavors of it. I won't go into it, but you should study it someday. Yeah, 3 is Nagya. Pride.
Okay.
I'll read you the definition. It's very interesting. A state of mind in which you take on the aspect of haughtiness or arrogance. Due to the power of grasping to self-existence. Of something about you.
Okay.
Like your looks or your strength or your intelligence or something like that. But what's interesting is that the definition has to include this deludedness about your self-existence. And we're going to talk more about it in the second half of the class after the break. But start to get in your mind this very, very, very important key. You know, this very trick about emptiness. You could not have pride if you did not have the tendency to grasp the things as self-existent. If you weren't believing in a thing that doesn't exist anyway, gotcha, you couldn't have pride in your mind.
What's that?
That's the whole point. You include it because to show that... But this is to teach students who didn't figure that out yet.
Okay.
In other words, if you weren't grasping to something about yourself as self-existent, you could not entertain the mental affliction called pride. It would be impossible. There ain't room in this town for both of us. And we talked about it before. You cannot be understanding the emptiness of something clearly and also entertain a mental affliction at the same time. It's impossible. What's the converse of that? If you're having a mental affliction, you must be grasping to something as self-existent. It's very interesting, okay? If your mind is not... And by the way, having a mental affliction means not having your mind at peace. If your mind is not at peace, if you are not contented, if you don't feel fulfilled, if you're nervous, irritated, stressed out, slightly longing for things, restless, channel surfing in life, you must be having a mental affliction. And if you're having a mental affliction, you must be holding something as self-existent. So how to cut it all off is getting obvious. You know, where to shut off the pipe is obvious. It's that dependent link, dependent origination link number one. So those Boston people know that one. Marigpa, the blind guy, okay? Ignorance, okay? That's why it's link number one on that wheel of life which surrounds the suffering. Okay. That's link number one. Okay, number four. Which, by the way, means if you want to see how your emptiness understanding is going, go to the person who pushes your buttons and see if it still works, you know. If they push your button successfully, your emptiness understanding is not too strong yet.
Okay.
Yeah. You collected a small bad deed, and then next time it'll be smaller, and next time it'll be smaller, and then sooner or later the reaction time lowers to zero, and that's nirvana.
Okay.
Say marigpa.
Marigpa.
Marigpa means ignorance. Ignorance. And very importantly is to understand what the Abhidharma says. If you use an example, it's a metaphor. Knowledge is a friend. Knowledge is a friend. Then marigpa, says the Abhidharma, is not simply the absence of the friend, it's the enemy. What that means? What it means is ignorance doesn't mean that you just don't know about it. It means that you are actively misknowing it. Okay? So ignorance is a little tricky, you know. When you say ignorance is bliss or ignorance is no excuse in the law, they mean you just didn't know about it. That ain't what it means in Buddhism. In Buddhism means you are actually actively, strongly holding the thing the opposite way. It's not that you just don't know about self-existence. You are strongly grasping to the opposite. I'm sorry, that things are self-existent, yeah. Not kind of like that. But what it means is, maybe it should be called misunderstanding. In what way? They have to go through talking about that because somebody thought it wasn't. Yeah. In the Abhidharma. Yeah. Okay, but there's no argument about, I mean, the bottom line is it is an active misknowing of things.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fine. Tibetan 5 looks like 4. It messed me up for years. Hey, tetsam?
Tetsam?
Tetsam means doubt.
Okay.
And in the same breath, you have to say, the Buddha warned his students, meaning us too, that you must doubt Buddhism. You must be critical. You must doubt every single aspect. Don't believe what anybody says, doesn't matter who it is, when they get up and talk about Buddhism. You must examine it yourself. It must check out with your own mind. You have to be able to confirm it, or you shouldn't accept it. He was very adamant about it. If you accept even the smallest detail, just because you like the teacher, or you don't have time to think much about it, or for any other reason, especially because you're attracted to the physical appearance of the teacher or to the personality of the teacher or something like that, big boo-boo. You know, you must, independent of the teacher's ugly, handsome, smart, stupid, expresses themselves well, doesn't express themselves well, famous, not famous, you know, has a long biography, doesn't have a long biography, had this person as their teacher, didn't have this person as their teacher, forget it. You have to be able to confirm everything they say by your own understanding. It has to check out with what you know, and it has to make sense to you. Otherwise, don't accept it. So that's not what tetsam means. Doubt doesn't mean that. That kind of doubt, that kind of critical mind, that kind of analytical mind is a great virtue. This is not, okay? Because it says, Nyomong Chen. Say Nyomong Chen. Nyomong Chen. Nyomong is that word for mental affliction. It has to be a mental affliction down. Which means something like continuing to doubt what has been proved to you. Continuing to doubt what makes sense in every sense. And for no better reason than that mommy and daddy said it to you when you were a kid, you doubt the opposite. For example, there's absolutely no logical proof that the mind stops when the body dies. There is none. There is no convincing evidence at all, period, that the mind stops when the body dies. There's not. The body, due to its own causes, due to its own nature, broke down. The mind can't express itself with that body anymore because it's broken. It's like a guy sitting in a car. I'm going to say the driver died because the tire went flat. The car's not moving anymore, the driver must have died. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Just because the machine died doesn't mean that the driver is dead. Maybe the driver can't get the machine to work anymore, so the driver went somewhere else, or something like that. In other words, there ain't no convincing evidence at all that the mind stops when the body dies. There just ain't. But because we grew up with that, you doubt it. You know, you tend to doubt it.
Yeah.
I know, yeah. So all the mental functions are contained in the brain, including sensation, which is a mental function. Including sensation, which is a mental function. The ability to feel things. So I can cut your fingers off. No problem. Okay, anyway. No, what I mean is, yeah. But that's just because the electricity stopped. Okay, Buddhism would say that's a function of the machine and not a function of the mind, which is resting on the machine. Okay, the mind obviously has a deep relationship with the machine. Obviously, no one can deny that. And obviously, when the machine is badly damaged, it hurts the mind. When you drink alcohol, the mind gets stupid. There must be a connection between the body and the mind, but there's no convincing evidence that just because the electricity flow of the mind stops, that invisible, untouchable, uncuttable, unmeasurable, unrestricted, my mind could go to the refrigerator in the Geshe house right now. It's not restricted to my skin, forget it. It can go beyond my skin. That ineffable thing disappears when the physical stuff stops. There's no proof for that. That's just an example. So tetsam is continuing to cling to doubts which you should have figured out a long time ago. But just because you're too lazy, basically. All right. Number six. Say tawa.
Tawa.
They translate it as wrong view. Wrong views. Okay, there's five. Wrong views. I sweated a lot over that translation. Wrong to me means don't do that. You know, that's wrong. It seems like a judgmental thing. And so that, in that sense, I'm a little nervous about the translation wrong. Maybe say incorrect or inaccurate or something. Not too sure about the translation view. This is the Tibetan word for to look at something. But I would say more like worldview. Okay? A mistaken worldview. There are five flavors of it. Okay? I would almost prefer to call it a mistaken worldview. Which is not judgmental like wrong, and I don't know, it's more broad than saying view, because it is a world view. It's how you view your world. Okay, and there's five flavors. I'll just go over them quickly and then we'll take a break. Number one is called jikta, which is the big troublemaker. It's grasping to you or yours, me or mine, as being self-existent. It's believing that me or mine is self-existent. That's jikta. That's number one. It's called perishable view because it's focused on something which will perish, which is you. And also because if you apply the right antidotes, you can kill it, and it's perishable. Okay, but I'm not going to get into all that. Number two is called tartha. Say tartha. Extreme views. Extreme views. Extreme views is a little tricky. It is a necessary consequence of thinking number one. Okay. If you believe in number one, you'll have number two. To put it very briefly, and we're going to cover this in another class, it's to think like this. Somebody comes up to you in a Buddhism class and says, you have never had a correct perception in your whole existence. Okay? Things aren't the way you thought they were. Okay? And then as a reaction to that, you say, well, then nothing exists at all. And that's an extreme view. So this view is called extreme view. What are the two extremes? By the way, in the middle is what we call what? Madhyamika. Okay? Professor Thurman's daughter. Uma. Middle way. The middle way. That's the middle. What are the two extremes? Let's say it in plain English. Extreme number one is everything's just the way I always thought it was. Everything is just the way I always thought it was. Everything is just the way it seems to me. That's extreme number one. That's called the extreme of existence. Yata. Everything is just the way I thought it was. And then some lama comes to a class and says, every perception you ever had is wrong. So you think to yourself, if it ain't the way I thought it was, it must not matter at all. It must not exist at all. That's extreme number two. Okay. If it ain't the way I thought it was, it doesn't exist at all. And oftentimes attached to wrong view number two there is, and I can do whatever the hell I want to do. You know, the world is an illusion. Samsara and nirvana are the same. It doesn't matter whether I'm ethical or not. It's all empty anyway. Okay. Okay. Crazy wrong view. Total, absolute, ultimate wrong view. Okay. So those are two flavors. Either everything's the way I thought it was, which is called yata, or if it's not that, then nothing matters, or nothing exists at all. And a Madhyamika, a Buddhist, has to stay in the middle. Between those two. We have to thread the line between those two. That's Madhyamika. That's the meaning of Madhyamika. Okay, number three. Say Lokta. Lokta means wrong view. Okay, this one is just called view, right? But this is the flavor called wrong view. Wrong view meaning opposite view. Okay, opposite view. And what it means is, you think that things that don't exist do exist, and you think that things that do exist don't exist. And the examples are two. Future lives, past and future lives. Okay? If without any evidence you don't accept them, it's lokta. Okay? If you can't accept them yet because you don't have enough good evidence, that's not lokta. That's good critical Buddhist mind. That's fine. That's great. If you can't accept it yet because you haven't gotten enough proof for it, that's not lokta. If you don't accept it after getting enough proof for it, or if you don't accept it and you really truly believe it cannot exist only because your mommy and daddy said that or something like that, that's lokta. Okay, lokta is a stupid belief in something, or a stupid belief that something's impossible for no good reason at all. Okay, that's lokta. For example, not believing in past and future lives, assuming there's no past and future lives without thinking about it. Okay, that's lokta. Second example would be to believe that enlightenment itself is not possible, for example, or that seeing emptiness directly is not possible. Something like that. That's a pretty classic lokta. It doesn't mean you shouldn't doubt or be critical. Okay, we talked about that. And Maitreya has a beautiful line in a scripture where he says, if it don't sound right yet, just shelve it, okay? But don't reject it. If you reject it, you collect very, very bad karma. Because it does exist. So, just shelve it for now. Put it in a category of things that I'll check on those later. I can't accept those things yet. And I think every American Buddhist has a certain number of those. There's a certain number of things that they say in the teachings that I just can't buy that yet. The important thing is don't reject it. Don't say it's stupid or something like that. Say, I can't buy that yet. My trail said, just put it on the shelf. I'll keep it over here until some guy shows up and explains it to me in a way that I can accept. Lokta or shelving it? He says, Tang Yong Su Shak. Tang Yong Su Shak means to leave it in equanimity. Okay. But don't reject it. Feng Wan Ma Che means don't reject it. Okay. Number four is Tawa Chong Jin. Say Tawa Chong Jin. It is thinking that your other wrong views are perfect. Holding on to your other wrong views and saying, my views are correct. All my world views are just right. Okay. Tawa Chong Jin. Holding your own views to be perfectly correct. Number five is Su Chim Dan Tu Shik Chong Jin Yit Tawa. That's a long one. What it means is to believe in certain kinds of, in certain spiritual practices which are harmful, and particularly harmful to you. For example, any kind of spiritual practice that would hurt your body. Okay, like whipping yourself or not eating for 6 days and hurting yourself, or I've even seen Buddhists who insisted on doing certain prostrations for until their legs were hurt and until they're actually handicapped. That's not Buddhism. Okay, that's not a good practice. That's wasting a precious opportunity. Don't do spiritual practices which hurt you. Okay. This also includes like very wrong views about what is the right thing to do. For example, in India at a certain point, there was a teacher who said, free sex, you know. Sex is like a flower by the roadside, and everyone should just go and pick it, you know. And he said that. And that would be Sutram Tushi Chongjin Yitawa. That would be a wrong view. To say that, oh, you know, don't be hung up. Everything's all right, you know. Just love each other, and physically too, and other people's wives, and other people's husbands, and it's just a joy. You know, that would be a classical wrong view. Let your anger out. Express your anger. Don't bottle it up. You know, yell at your boss back. You know, there is a virtue to resolving something by bringing it out in the open. That's not what I'm talking about. But to say that it's a virtue or that it's beneficial to harm somebody back because they hurt you, an eye for an eye is total wrong view. Classical wrong view number five. Okay. Last thing to say before the break. I keep saying it, right? What are the three spheres in the act of that prediction? We're getting back to the prediction. Because the Buddha, because that young man reached a point where he stopped these six totally, permanently, forever, then the Buddha came up to him and said, hey, cool, you are going to be Shakyamuni Buddha on such and such a planet in such and such a year. Now I can tell you that. I can predict it. There's a predictor who is Dipamkara Buddha, okay, the Manmenze. There's a Buddha who's predicting that this guy is going to become Shakyamuni. There's the Buddhahood which he is predicting. There's a boy who's being predicted too. Okay. And there's an emptiness of each one of those three. And the Buddha would never do such a prediction without seeing that emptiness at that moment. Okay. And that's why it comes up in the Dhammakaya Sutra here. The Buddha says to Subhuti, when that Buddha came up to me and put his hand on my head and said, hey, great job. You removed your mental afflictions permanently. Now you're going to be called Shakyamuni Buddha after so and so many years. You'll reach enlightenment. But at that moment, that Buddha wasn't thinking of me as self-existent. And that Buddha wasn't thinking of himself as self-existent. And that Buddha didn't see the whole prediction as being self-existent. Okay. If he had, he wouldn't have been a Buddha and there wouldn't have been any prediction. A prediction which is self-existent cannot exist. It's a gotcha. There was something going on. There was some emptiness going on at that moment. Or there could not have been a prediction. There were three emptinesses going on at that moment. Or there couldn't have been a prediction. Okay. We're going to talk about those three emptinesses after the break. So have a nice break. Come back in 10-15 minutes. Okay. Number six is view of the main mental afflictions. No, it's only five. So how, if you count the five views, how many major mental afflictions?
10.
Sometimes they say 10 because it's five that are view and five that aren't view. Okay. View is number six and has five. What's going on? Now we go into the higher school, Prasangika school. They say that this person at that point has overcome any manifest kind of grasping to self-existence. So what it means is,
thank you.
Once you've reached this level, things are not even appearing to you as self-existent anymore. Okay, remember that thing? That after you see emptiness directly, you don't believe it anymore, but things still look like that. Eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi, they're not looking like that anymore.
Okay?
That's the difference. Somebody asked me that question. I'll say it again. Until the time you reach the... Until the time you see emptiness directly, everything looks self-existent, and you believe everything is self-existent. After seeing emptiness directly, everything still looks self-existent. But you don't believe yourself anymore. You know you're crazy. Okay? At the eighth Bodhisattva Bhumi, you don't think they're self-existent anymore, and they don't look self-existent anymore. You still have extremely subtle seeds of that kind of perception. You still have extremely subtle seeds in your mind for seeing things as self-existent. But they'll never act again. And of course, according to the highest schools, the tendency to see things as self-existent is itself a mental affliction. Okay. The tendency to see things as self-existent is itself a mental affliction. So when you reach nirvana, it has to go away. Because nirvana is the permanent stopping of all your mental afflictions. Okay. That's the highest school's thought. Not all the schools accept that, but that is the way it is. Absolutely. That's why on a good painting of the Wheel of Life, and in a painting of the Wheel of Life which follows the original Vinaya lines from the Vinaya Sutra that tells you how to paint that picture, the pigeon, which is what it's supposed to be, and the snake are coming out of the mouth of the pig. Okay, the pig represents ignorance. And the first two major mental afflictions we talked about, liking things and disliking things ignorantly in such a way that it would cause you to do bad karma, is coming out of his mouth. You know, desire and anger. Okay? So it is the root of all evil. Yeah, somebody else can, yeah.
Bhumi?
Yeah. They don't look self-existent anymore. No. They are focusing on relative objects. That's tough. Things don't suggest self-existence to them anymore. They don't look self-existent. As they look at it, they are totally aware of its dependent origination. How's that? Visually, I believe it would be the same. A Buddha sees things. You know, a Buddha's mind is deceptive reality. It's not ultimate reality. A Buddha's body, the colors and shapes of a Buddha's body are deceptive reality. Deceptive, why do they call it deceptive? To the mind of a normal person, the way they look and the way they are is different. Anything that's like that would be deceptive reality. So Buddhists can see deceptive reality, but they don't get fooled by it. And neither do eighth level Bodhisattvas. Okay, we'll go, one more. I'm sorry, say again.
Your direct experience of emptiness would be the same as my direct experience of emptiness.
Yeah.
But then after that, so once we're at the eighth level, then would one Buddha's experience, deceptive reality that they're not fooled by, and that
right.
be the
right.
same as the other?
No. Let me put it this way. When you perceive emptiness directly at the path of seeing, as a bodhisattva, that direct experience of emptiness, and the direct experience of emptiness by a Buddha, in terms of their content, is totally, perfectly, absolutely the same. You can't see emptiness any better than you do at the path of seeing. It's not like your ability to see emptiness changes. It's not like the emptiness changes. You're either seeing ultimate reality or you're not. Once you see it once, it's as ultimate as it'll ever get. That's why it's ultimate. That's what ultimate means. Now she's asking, suppose given that fact, let's say, does a bodhisattva at the eighth bhumi, does his perception of normal stuff and the perception of a Buddha, are they different? Completely different. Okay, a Buddha is perceiving everything that was, everything that is, and everything that shall be simultaneously in every corner of the universe. At the same moment. And also all ultimate realities in the universe at the same moment. That they're looking at Lamayashi Stupa, okay? Does one Buddha's experience of ultimate reality differ from another Buddha's experience of ultimate reality? I mean, does one Buddha's experience differ from another Buddha's experience, even in terms of regular stuff? Obviously not. They're both seeing every existing object that ever was, is, or will be simultaneously. So, I mean, that content is totally the same.
At the eighth level.
Yeah. Do they merge into one being or something like that? No, never. Okay? Never. Each individual consciousness is always and forever separate. That's why I cannot collect karma for you. And that's why I cannot share my karma with you. You know, I could be perceiving this week of classes as me standing among a bunch of tantric deities who are just trying to humor me into teaching a class that will help me be a better person. I could be perceiving it truly that way. And you could be perceiving it as a regular old Vajrapani thing, and they're trying to get me to go to this dinner and everything, and you could be having a totally different experience of it. I cannot share my experience with you. Impossible. I can't take out 20% of it and stick it in your mind stream. Your karma is restricted to the particular mind stream of the person who's collecting it. All a Buddha can do for you is come into the world and teach so that you can change yourself. But they can't change you for yourself. If they could, they woulda. And we wouldn't be here. Alright? But they didn't, right? Okay, yeah.
But in this text it said that the Buddha took a piece of Buddha out of his mouth and gave it to the Buddha, I think it wasn't. The Buddha tasted what the Buddha tasted.
Not exactly. The Buddha tasted
a little
rush out of it. Yeah, no. The Buddha tasted some food. Didn't have the experience with the otherwise he would have had the experience of the emptiness of food and the food at the same moment, or something like that, directly. One more question, then we got to go on. I don't mind to stay, but I assume some people would like to have lunch and stuff. Did you have a question? No? Okay. Okay. All right. Yeah, each Buddha has collected exactly the same kind of an amount of karma, which is allowing them to see every single object in the universe at once. So the karma that they collected was ultimately the same kind of karma, but it is individual. They're not merging into one universal Buddha or something like that. Each of them is in a Buddha paradise, which happens to be exactly like the other Buddha paradise, but it's individual. Because they've collected every possible, what's that word in English? Permutation of karma, of good karma. Okay. Each one has collected every possible permutation of good karma, and is perceiving every kind of pleasant thing that exists. Okay. Ultimately. Okay. What's all this stuff got to do with your day-to-day life? Okay. I mean, what's this all? And this was where I personally always had problem with these teachings. You know, every time I went to a teaching on emptiness, every time I went to a Buddhist teaching, it was either Lam Rim or mental training Lojong, and they're telling you how to cope with life, how to cope with this lousy life. You know, they're not talking about changing it necessarily, they're just telling you, here's how you can try to transform it into something more palatable, which wasn't my interest, you know. I mean, a more palatable, lousy life, wasn't really what I was after. I mean, it's nice. I mean, it's nice not to get as angry as you used to get. But to make samsara more palatable didn't seem like a big deal. Okay, so I'm a little bit happier as I get old and die. But I'm interested in the old and die part. I mean, Buddha said you can get over kiga nachi.
He said, you can overcome the four sufferings. You don't have to die anymore. You don't have to get old anymore. You don't have to get sick. He didn't say, you don't have to have blow-ups like you used to. You can just have minor irritations. You know what I mean? He didn't say that. He promised something much more extreme. Much more extreme. He said, you don't have to get old like you used to. You don't have to die like you used to. You don't have to get sick like you used to. That was what I was interested in. So it seemed to me you were either getting two extremes. Some people get up and talk about how not to get mad at the boss by thinking of him in certain ways. Or else they were talking about this very, very technical emptiness thing that I couldn't see any logical application to my life. You know, from what they were saying, I'd have to go into meditation all the time and somehow see some kind of blankness or voidness, and then I wouldn't get mad at anybody because they wouldn't be there anymore. Or something like that. You know, they seem to be very opposite, or they seem to be very disconnected. And at this point in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Buddha addresses that question. Don't forget, Buddhas are omniscient. They're very sneaky. They can speak a sutra 2,500 years ago, knowing that we will be sitting here wondering, what the hell has this got to do with my life? You know, it's not at all difficult for them to plan this sort of thing. For them, planning 2,500 years from now in Vajrapani is no more difficult than planning what they're going to do when they get up out of their meditation. And for them, it's exactly the same distance, because they're omniscient. So they planned for us, and they said, these guys are going to wonder, what the heck this got to do with their life? And the next part of the sutra is talking about a great Buddhist saint who lived in the land of the king of Kalinka. Okay? Sounds like calling card, I guess. Kalinka. And the story goes like this. This Buddhist saint was who had perceived emptiness directly is sitting in the forest meditating. And the king's wife happens along with her ladies-in-waiting. And she sees the saint. She has a lot of faith and a lot of devotion. So she approaches the saint. I believe his name was Suparma. I'm not sure. I'm trying to confirm it. But that means patient one, okay? And she says, I have some questions to ask you about Buddhism. And she starts to ask him questions. And the ladies-in-waiting are kind of wandering around. And she's sitting next to this saint talking about Buddhism, asking him questions. And the king happens to go out for a ride. He's riding along, he's on a hunt or something, and he's riding along, and he comes into this clearing. There's his wife with this Buddhist yogi, you know, and he gets angry. He assumes there's been some fooling around going on. So he has all his other bodyguard with him, and he says, okay, you guys get down off your horses and tie this guy down to the ground. So they spread eagle him on the ground, this Buddhist saint. And then he gets a knife and he says, and he starts to slowly cut off the saint's fingers and then his hands and his toes and his feet and his legs, and he just slowly amputates each part of his body. Very slowly. Okay. I believe this might have been a former life of the Buddha. Check the sutra, okay? He's probably speaking from personal experience. In fact, he is, as I remember. He was that saint. And so he's speaking from what really happened to him. And then the Buddha says to Subhuti, by the way, I didn't get angry at all. You know, I didn't get upset at all. Okay. While they were cutting off my fingers and hands, I did not get upset. Did he feel pain? He did feel pain. It did hurt. And he says that. Says it hurt. He says, but I did not get upset, and I did not hate the king. I did not feel like Nursem. Nursem we talked about before. I did not feel any kind of hatred towards the king. It didn't occur in my mind in the least that I should try to hurt this king back, or I should try to get back at this king, or I should try to do anything to the king. He says, it did not even occur to me. And in the next line he says, because I didn't see anything about that situation that was self-existent. And then in the next line he says, if I had seen anything as self-existent while he was cutting off my fingers and my toes, I would have gotten angry. So there's the whole spiel right there. It's very cool. So all the clue is there. You know, what's this got to do with your life? You know, how's it going to help you with the boss is in your face? The guy boss is in my face. The woman boss is his wife. Mm-hmm. Is pushing my buttons. I call them button pusher and face in my face, you know. And she doesn't get in my face, but she does other things. She somehow, you know, I think that Chaka Samaran is wife or something. But they know exactly what to do to get me upset. Especially after I'll go back after teaching this class, and by 10 o'clock they'll do it to me, you know. And and what is it to perceive the emptiness of that situation, you know? And it goes back to what we said before. If you're having a mental affliction, what's the litmus test of having a mental affliction? How do you know you're in the midst of a mental affliction? Your peace of mind is upset. Somehow. Irritated, nervous, stressed, angry, any kind of lack of contentment or peace of mind, a mental affliction is operating. Okay? It cannot be operating if you're perceiving the emptiness of the situation clearly, it says. Does it have to be direct? Almost couldn't be direct, okay? Or else you wouldn't get paid for that hour, I guess. Because you can't pick up a diamond during that hour. You can't have any normal perception during that time. So it doesn't mean that. It means while the saint was having his fingers cut off by the king, he looked at the situation. And it's the same as the screaming boss. It's just a little more painful, okay? What was going on? Why didn't he react? Why didn't he respond to violence with violence? He would be just perpetuating it, okay? If you want to meet another king who comes and cuts your fingers off, then do violence back to him. And you'll guarantee that you will meet another king who will come and cut your fingers off. Because that's where he came from in the first place. Okay? You're getting your fingers cut off not because you were sitting that close to his wife. You're getting your fingers cut off because you cut off somebody else's fingers before that. Okay? If you want to have this thing happen again, if you want to perpetuate it, what is the word for samsara in Tibetan? Korwa. Korwa means circle. It means what do you call it? There's a word in English. A vicious circle. Vicious circle. That's samsara. The word samsara means vicious circle. Vicious circle in English means what? The Israelis do violence to the Arabs. So the Arabs, because their son was killed, has to kill one of the Israelis. So one of the Israelis has to say, well, one of the Israelis, I got killed two Arabs. And then they say, well, I also got to swear that I have to kill his father, you know. And then it's this vicious circle that never ends. Because each event is perpetuating the next event. And here's the trick, here's the rub, here's the point of the class. The natural reaction to someone hurting you is to hurt them back. That is also the precise karmic cause to make them come back and hurt you again. And that's why samsara is a vicious circle. So break it. How do you break it? Just don't react. Okay, now if somebody comes up and says, hey, just don't react when someone punches you in the head. Turn the other cheek. Let them punch you on the other side of your face. I mean, I grew up, it wasn't until like 25 that I understood what turn the other cheek means. It means if they punch you on this side of your head, go up to them and say, would you like to punch me on the other side of my head? You know? Okay, what it means is, don't react, but don't react because you understand what's going on. If you just, someone comes up and teaches you, don't react, you'll never be able to implement it. You know that. You know it's wrong to yell back at somebody. You know it's wrong to do violence to somebody. But because you don't have an understanding of emptiness, you can't do it. If you do have an understanding of emptiness, you will be able to do it. And it's the only thing that'll allow you not to do it. That's the perfection of wisdom. And that's how the perfection of wisdom helps you. Okay? You just know that because the thing is empty, it's happening to you because you did it to someone before, and the last thing in the world you want to do is to make it go on in a vicious circle. So with knowledge, because of your knowledge, you don't respond with violence. Now, in the same breath, and then I'll take some questions, I have to say, I'm talking about violence with anger. Okay, I'm talking about violence motivated by a mental affliction. I'm not talking about forceful action on the part of a Buddhist. Okay, I didn't say A Buddhist can't take forceful action. If that boss or anyone else is harming another person and you have the capacity to stop it, you must act. Your bodhisattva vows require it. Even forceful action. Your bodhisattva vows require it. Okay? You are required to take even very forceful actions to help another person. And in a very limited way, you are even required to do violence to a person if the situation calls for it. You are allowed to break 6 of the first 7 bad deeds. What are they? If you're a monk, okay? If you're a layman, you can break all 7. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh talk, idle gossip. You're allowed to do all 7 if it would be of extraordinary benefit to another person. And by the way, if you've been a bodhisattva for millions of years. Really. So we don't really have to worry about that. But in theory, okay, in theory, I repeat, you could be required to undertake a very violent action against someone if it was the only way to prevent them from hurting others and themselves. Okay. What about the last 3 non-virtues? Never ever, as my Lama would say. His English is very idiomatic. He learns most of his English from TV commercials. So I think, never ever. You know? You can't break the last 3. The mental non-virtues never can be of any use to anybody. They can never be applied in a situation, in an extraordinary situation, to aid somebody. Forget it. So what it means is, although you may be required to fight back to the boss if he's hurting someone, you can never hate him. You can never do it with the slightest bit of anger. I always tell people, if your heart's getting faster, forget it. Just shut up. You ain't ready yet. You know, best thing to do is just to shut up. Don't respond. Okay? If your heart starts going ding, 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 you know, and your hands are getting sweaty, and it's very common for certain people at that point to say, oh yeah, in that Buddhism class they said, you got to respond forcefully if someone's in danger. So it's okay if I yell right now, because you want to yell. Not because you have any kind of compassion going on. You just feel like it. So you twist Buddhism to fit your own desires, which is very common. So what I mean to say is, the reason I got into that was, Buddhism doesn't say you have to sit there and be wimpy. Never said that. Don't respond with a mental affliction. If you're responding with a mental affliction, you're perpetuating your own vicious cycle. And if you want it to go on, if you want to meet that unpleasant object again, then let your natural reaction come out. Because that's exactly the one that got him there in the first place. Okay. There was one more point on the homework, and then I'll take a few questions. So, by the way, if on the homework it said, why didn't that saint respond to the king? Why didn't he try to get the king back? He did not want to perpetuate the vicious cycle. Okay. Yeah. There is a famous incident in scripture. That scripture doesn't mention what he did, but there is a famous scripture called Udayana Abhidhana, which my Lama is he made us study it in great detail. And at a point in that scripture, a person who is an arhat and an arya, he's already seen emptiness directly, he doesn't have any more mental afflictions. He's about to be murdered by assassins sent by his own son. King Udayana is about to be murdered. And he can see enough of the... He has enough wisdom that he knows who these people are. They're like saying, we have to talk to you, king, you know. And he knows that they have knives under their sleeves, and he knows they're about to murder him. And it's in the scripture it says, out of compassion he tried to get away. Out of compassion for them and for his son, he tried to escape. But his karma kept him there. He could not escape. He had the power to fly, for example. But at that moment, the power failed him. So even for an arhat, you're still caught up in your old bad karma. Okay. Yeah.
You say that the saint being cut up didn't become angry because he didn't want to perpetuate his karma and be defeated. Right. Doesn't that imply that he was grasping at his own self-existence and protecting his future in that way?
You can protect your sutra and not grasp your self-existence. And in fact, you know, the three elements in that situation, he's the Kari, right? So he's one of the three spheres. He's not perceiving himself. He does have some. He does have some. If he's not an arhat, well, yeah. If he's not an arhat yet, he is perceiving himself somewhat as being self-existent. And he probably is, not intellectually, but he's inherently, he's by nature, he's by the nature of any living being who's not an arhat, he is grasping onto some self-existence of the situation. But apparently not enough to be angry, which implies that he was either an arhat or very close. Okay, yeah. It's fine, no problem. Don't forget that, she said, if the only person you were helping when you were responding with strength, let's say strength and not violence, okay? If the only person you're helping when you respond with strength is yourself, is that allowable? Oh yeah, taking care of yourself is the foundation of taking care of all sentient beings, okay? When you talk about taking care of everybody, you is one of those sentient beings, okay? Really, you are one of those sentient beings, and you have as much responsibility to care for yourself as you do for them. Caring for yourself means getting the Buddhahood as fast as you can, which happens to be the best thing you can do for everybody else also. So no problem. It's kind of cool. The best thing you can do for yourself is get to enlightenment. The best thing you can do for others is to get yourself to enlightenment. So no problem. Yeah. Absolutely. We don't distinguish between, you know, those four words you learned for being, person, living being, sentient being, self. They apply to all five realms. Hell beings, animals, pretas, humans, everybody. Yeah. Yeah. I'd say proceed with force with caution. Yeah. No, it's a good question, you know. Are you supposed to sit there like a vegetable until the day you become an arhat? No. But the human capacity to fool yourself is infinite. And especially with regard to spiritual things and ethical things. So that's all I can say. The nature of fooling yourself is you can't stop yourself, but try to stop yourself. Yeah. Well, that's why I'm talking about responding with strength if it's necessary. If you see that it would be harmful to them, for them to continue to act badly, you're required by your bodhisattva vows to respond with force. Yeah. It happens to me. It happens to me at work. For example, there's a bodhisattva vow that you must respond to a person's question. Especially if it's sincerely asked. You know, if a person asks you a question, you are required to respond sincerely, you know, thoughtfully. And then the text says, Miksa, Nyeme. Do you remember Nyeme? Nyeme is a wonderful thing. Nyeme is our exception, okay? And the Nyeme listed in the text, one of them is, if by dissing the other person, you know, in New York it's dissing, right? If by disrespecting the other person they would learn a valuable lesson, you are required not to answer. Or you are required to make a flippant answer that would upset them if you know it would help them. It's very interesting. That's part of that bodhisattva vow. But it requires great wisdom in its application. You know, obviously. You know, if you truly care about the other person and truly concerned about their welfare, and you know that by not answering them or by giving them a flippant answer, their spiritual progress would be advanced, you're required not to answer sincerely. Okay. Very touchy. Very, very touchy. And again, you can fool yourself very easily. In other words, you have to do at any given time what's best for the other person. And for yourself. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It comes in the bodhisattva vows again. There's a bodhisattva vow that you cannot teach emptiness to a person if, according to your best judgment, it would harm them. And specifically, if they would lose their faith in Buddhism, and specifically, if they would lose their faith in Mahayana Buddhism. If by teaching someone emptiness, they would gain the wrong view that the bodhisattva way of life is crazy or irrelevant or something like that, then the moment that they get that idea in their mind and they reject the bodhisattva way of life, you have broken your bodhisattva vow. Okay? That's the definition of teaching someone emptiness when they're not ready. Right after that in the scripture it says, Getsel Kapa examines your question. He says, now what if you, to the best of your knowledge, thought that it would be alright to teach them? You thought that they would...